Not one for riding in a buckboard. Smoke let Sally drive the rig while he rode next to it on his big Palouse stud, Stormy. The Bronc name reflected both his personality and his color, which was gray with a dark-spotted white rump. Without Smoke's permission, no one could come within 5 feet of that horse without risking serious injury. As he rode down the trail toward town, Smoke glanced at Sally, recalling her playfulness in the bedroom just before they left. When it suited her to do so, Sally wore men's pants, though this morning she was wearing a dress. No matter how she was dressed, she was never without her nickel-plated .32 revolver. She wasn't a fast draw artist, but she was smooth with it, and she always hit where she aimed. He smiled as he thought of the two men who had accosted her yesterday. The one named Spieg didn't know how lucky he was to still have his privates. If she had wanted to, she could have taken him apart one ball at a time. When they reached Big Rock and rode down Main Street, many of the citizens they passed called out and waved. Part of it was because the Jensens were well known and respected in the town Smoke had helped to form, and they knew most everyone by their first names. But part of it was because of the way Sally had handled herself with the two ruffians who had accosted her. Word had spread quickly throughout the town. Sheriff Monte Carson was sitting on the boardwalk in front of his office with a cup of coffee in one hand and his ever-present pipe in the other. He had his chair tilted back on two legs, and his feet were braced on the hitching rail in front of him.
Howdy!
Meet you at Longmont's.
Carson nodded, and then he pitched his coffee onto the dirt. Smoke and Monte Carson had become very good friends over the past few years. Carson had once been a well-known gunfighter, though he had never ridden the Alhu Trail. A local rancher, Tilden Franklin, who planned to take over the county, had hired Carson to be the sheriff of Fontana, a town just down the road from Smoke Sugarloaf Spread. When Carson learned that the man's plans were to have a sheriff who would just wink at his lawlessness, he put his foot down and informed Franklin that Fontana was going to be run in a law-abiding manner from then on. Franklin sent a bunch of his riders in to teach the upstart sheriff a lesson. The men killed Carson's two deputies and seriously wounded him, taking over the town. In retaliation, Smoke founded the town of Big Rock, and he and his band of aging gunfighters cleaned up the town of Fontana. When the fracas was over, Smoke offered the job of sheriff of Big Rock to Monte Carson. Carson married a grass widow and settled into the job like he was born to it. Neither Smoke nor the citizens of Big Rock had ever had cause to regret his taking the job. Heavy said, and growing a bit of a paunch, thanks both to his wife's excellent cooking and his aversion to any real physical labor, Carson was still quick as a snake with a handgun, and he was as honest as a gold coin. If you obeyed the law and didn't cause any trouble in his town, you weren't going to have no trouble with him. Down the street, Smoke dismounted and helped Sally tie the two-horse rig up to a rail in front of the general store. Sally went inside, and Smoke went to the hardware store to order his supplies. Then he went to Longmont's. Smoke walked down to Longmont's, and as was his custom, once inside, he stepped immediately to the side and pressed his back up against the wall. He stood there a moment, letting his eyes adjust to the lower light inside while he looked for possible trouble among the patrons. Even though he knew he was almost as safe in his friend's restaurant as he was in his own house, he'd been hunted and tracked for more than half his life, and the habit of caution was so ingrained in him that he didn't even notice he was doing it anymore. The owner of the saloon and restaurant, Lewis Longmont, was sitting at his usual table in the corner. He watched his friend go through his regular ritual upon entering the place where Lewis plied his trade of gambling, which he euphemistically called teaching amateurs the laws of chance. Lewis was a lean, hawk-faced man, strong, slender hands, long fingers, carefully manicured nails. He had jet black hair and a black pencil-thin mustache. He was dressed in a black suit with a white shirt and a crimson ascot, something he'd picked up on a trip to England some years back. He wore low-heeled boots and a pistol hung in tied-down leather on his right side. The pistol was nickel-plated with ivory handles, but it wasn't just for show, because Lewis was snake-quick and a fear-deadly gun hand when pushed. Although Lewis was engaged in a profession that did not have a very good reputation, he wasn't an evil man. He had never hired his gun out for money, and while he could make a deck of cards do almost anything he wanted, he had never cheated at poker. He didn't have to cheat. He was possessed of a phenomenal memory. He could tell you the odds of filling any type of poker hand, and he was an expert at the technique of card counting. Lewis was just past 30. When he was a small boy, Lewis left Louisiana and came west with his parents. His parents had died in a shantytown fire, leaving the boy to cope as best he could. And Lewis had coped quite well, applying his innate intelligence and willingness to take a chance into a fortune. He owned a large ranch up in Wyoming Territory, several businesses in San Francisco, and a hefty chunk of a railroad. Smoke glanced over and saw his friend smiling at him. He returned the grin, then moved across the floor to take a seat at Lewis's table.
Coffee?
You bet.
Andre, a cup of your best for our friend here.
Andre placed a china cup and saucer in front of Smoke and filled it from the silver service set that Lewis always had on his table.
I see you're still as cautious as ever when entering a room.
It's been so long, it's the only way I know.
It's hardly the most enjoyable way of living. Always having to look over one's shoulder for some miscreant from one's past.
Yes, it's a terrible way to live. But it beats the hell out of a bullet in the back.
You always have had the most succinct way of putting things in perspective, Smoke.
So, what's been happening with you?
Not much, except for the little show your Sally put on for us the other day when she ran those two galoots off. The town's been as dull as dishwater, and it's been that way for the past few weeks. Why, I haven't had an interesting opponent in poker for the entire month.
But I'll bet that didn't keep you from taking most of their weekend pay now, did it?
Oh, I'm always willing to give lessons in the noble art of poker, even to those who will never learn from their mistakes.
Smoke was about to say that their first mistake was sitting down across a card table from Lewis Longmont when Sheriff Monte Carson ambled through the bat wing. Lewis looked over and saw that Andre had seen the sheriff arrive as well, and he was already bringing another cup and saucer to the table. Carson sat down and grimaced as he pulled his chair up to the table.
Something ailing you, Monty?
That's just this rheumatiz, Smoke. Hell, at my age, if it don't hurt, it don't work.
You're not all that old, Monty.
It ain't the years, Lewis. It's the miles, and I got plenty of miles on this old carcass.
Hell, I'll drink to that.
How about some lunch?
I'd better wait for Sally. She's over at the general store buying clothes. That'll probably cost more than the fencing and wire I just bought.
Well, at least she's still interested in looking nice for you. My wife could wear burlap sacks and be just as happy.
Excuse me, gentlemen. If you two old marriage gents are going to reveal all the secrets of your marriages in front of this old bachelor, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take my leave before I become terminally embarrassed.
That'll be the day.
Yeah. About the only time I ever seen Lewis embarrassed was the time we was playing poker, and he tried to bluff you with a king high hand, and you called him and beat him with a pair of deuces, Smoke.
It was the correct play. Smoke should have folded.
That's what you get for playing with amateurs, Lewis. We don't always do what we're supposed to do.
Amateur hell. Give me 2 weeks and I can make you as good as any poker player in the country, Smoke.
Not my game, Lewis. I'm just an ordinary old rancher now.
Yeah. You'll be an ordinary old rancher when pigs fly.
Just as Andre was refilling the silver service with a fresh supply of coffee, a young boy about 11 or 12 stepped hesitantly through the bat wings.
Your customer's getting a mite younger here lately, Lewis.
Lewis raised his eyebrows at the youngster, and then he beckoned him over to the table.
Yes, Tommy, what is it?
Tommy nervously handed Smoke Jensen a telegram, obviously nervous to be in the gunfighter's presence. Smoke dug in his pocket and gave the boy a dime. That boy's smile beamed, and he quickly ran off. Smoke read the telegram and narrowed his eyes in thought for a moment.
Trouble?
Yes, from someone I owe a whole lot to. Seems he's in trouble and is wondering if I might be able to help him out.
What kind of trouble?
He doesn't say. But since he's asking for my help, I suspect it's the kind of trouble that comes out of the end of a gun.
Just who is this hombre, anyway?
Bob Kleberg.
I've heard that name before, but I'm damned if I can remember where.
He used to be a lawyer for the governor of Colorado back before it became a state.
Ah, now I remember. He's the one that arranged for the governor to pardon you and Preacher before you moved up into this part of the country.
That's right. If it wasn't for him, I'd either still be on the run or I'd be rotting in jail somewhere.
And now he's calling in his debt?
Seems like.
Where is this man now, and what's he doing?
The letter says he's down in Texas, near the Mexican border, and that he's running a ranch for a fellow named King. He wants me to come down there and talk about his problem, and see if I can do anything to help him out.
All the way down to the Mexican border? That must be near 1,000 miles. That's a hell of a long journey just to talk about something.
Smoke didn't answer, but his eyes remained on the telegram still lying on the table.
What do you think Sally will say about you taking off on such a long trip?
Why don't you ask Sally?
Sally had entered without anybody seeing her, and she was standing just to one side of the table.
Sally, I see you come in.
What trip are you talking about?
Would you like a cup of coffee or tea, Sally?
Why, thank you, Lewis. I would very much appreciate a cup of Andre's wonderful coffee.
While Lewis poured, Sally looked at Smoke.
Go on, dear. You were just about to tell me about the trip you're taking?
You remember that man that worked for Governor Gilpin that I told you about? The one that got me and Preacher our pardons?
Uh-huh.
Seems like he's in a spot of trouble, and he's asked me to come down to Texas and help him out of it.
Texas?
Yeah, down around Corpus Christi, right near the Mexican border.
And you feel you owe this man a debt for what he did for you and Preacher?
I guess just about everything I have now is due to him one way or another, Sally. If he hadn't gotten me my pardon, I'd never been able to settle down and stay in one place for any length of time. I would have never even met you.
Then it's settled. We simply must go help this man out if he's in trouble, whatever it is.
Sally, I knew you'd understand. Wait a minute. Did you say we?
Yes. Texas should be very nice this time of year. It's spring and the wildflowers will be blooming. As a matter of fact, I'm looking forward to going.
But Sally...
Come along, dear. It's time we got home and packed for the trip.
Back at the Sugar Loaf, Smoke finally relented and quit trying to talk Sally out of making the trip with him. After all, how dangerous could it be? Whatever trouble Kleberg was in, Smoke could leave Sally in town at a nice hotel while he worked on it, and she'd be perfectly safe. Besides, he could take Cal and Pearly with him. If there were any serious trouble in the region, he could have them watch Sally while he concentrated on the bad guys, extricating Kleberg from whatever jam he'd gotten himself into. They made arrangements to take the train to Corpus Christi, and Smoke decided to bring their horses and extra gear with him by renting an entire cattle car. He had no idea what kind of mounts would be available that far south, but he knew he could depend on the big Palouse studs when the chips were down. Concepcion sat baking in the sun like a lizard on a hot rock, its dirt-colored adobe buildings rising from the ground as if they were an occurrence of nature rather than man-made. The little village was built in a square around the Catholic Church, which, as in most of the little Mexican villages in this part of Texas, was the most prominent building. A well in the center square provided water for the entire town. When Brant and his riders came to within a mile of the town, he held up his hand to halt his troops.
There it is, Concepcion.
You'll pardon me for saying so, Major, but that sure don't look like much of a town to me.
It's just right for our purposes. It'll have food, water, liquor, and horse to keep the men occupied. And it's far enough away from King's Ranch so as not to be discovered accidentally. but close enough that it'll be real easy for us to get down there, do our business, then leave. This will be our headquarters.
What about the sheriff?
You're looking at the sheriff.
You? You the sheriff?
Not yet, but I soon will be.
By the time Brant and his men reached the edge of town, several of its 170 residents, more than half of whom were Mexican, had learned of the arrival, either by the shouts of others or, in some cases, by the sound of hoofbeats from the 60 horses. In pairs and small groups, they left their homes and places of business to watch in interest and some anxiety as the riders approached. There had not been this many riders coming through town since the war, because these men were riding in the same orderly formation. Some wondered if another war had begun. The Catholic priest, Padre Julio Gonzalez, came out of his little church and stood at the side of the well, watching the riders arrive, wondering how their arrival might affect his people. The riders came all the way into the center square before Brant held up his hand. The little cloud of dust that had accompanied their entrance into the town now drifted away on a hot breath of air. Padre Gonzalez hurried out to address the obvious leader of the riders.
Puedo ayudar, señor?
What?
I am sorry. Excuse the Spanish. I asked if I may be of some help.
Sergeant, dismiss the men.
Troop, dismiss!
The men dismounted and started moving toward the two drinking establishments in town. One a Mexican cantina and one an American saloon.
Yeah, you can help me. Has this town got a sheriff?
Sí, el sheriff. Su oficina está ahí.
Speak American, you pig-faced bastard.
The smile left the padre's face, and with an expression of hurt and controlled anger, he pointed to the sheriff's office.
Come with me.
They started toward the building the padre had pointed out.
Esa es mi esposa! That is my wife! What are you doing, señor?
Sounds like the men are beginning to get settled in.
Without a second thought as to what the men might be doing, Brant and Stone continued toward a low-lying adobe building that had a sign over the door in both English and Spanish that said Office of the Sheriff. Brant drew his sword, looked over at Stone, and nodded. Stone drew his pistol, then he kicked the door open.
¿Qué es esto?
A change of command.
The sheriff's severed head bounced on the desk and then fell to the floor. The headless body fell backward, gushing blood from its truncated neck. Brant sat down behind the desk and put his feet up.
This will be our command post.
Despite its Spanish name, which meant Red Cat, the Gato Rojo was the American saloon in the small town. And while others in the town were frightened by the sudden appearance of so many Americans, Carl Kahn was doing a booming business. Right now, nearly 40 men were crowded into his place of business, standing at the bar or sitting at the tables. To Kahn's delight, they ordered food, drink, and hell, from time to time, they took one of the women into the little lean-to room at the back of the building. In the time Brant had been here, he and his men had taken over the town. The women of the town were staying in their homes, too frightened to go out into the street. Those who did go out were literally taking their lives into their own hands, especially today, because two of Brant's men were standing at the batwing doors of the Gato Rojo, taking pot shots at anyone who ventured onto the street. They weren't trying to kill them, mind you. They were just coming as close to them as they could without hitting. Kahn moved from one end of the long, rough-hewn bar to the other, answering the demands of the men as they ordered beer, tequila, or whiskey. He knew that he should resent them for being in his town and frightening his neighbors the way they were. He knew also that they had burglarized some of the stores in town, just taking what they wanted. But for some reason, here in the saloon, they were paying for their goods and services, including even the whores. And Kahn got one half of what the whores got. Maybe it was wrong of him, but realistically, what could he do? He was just one man. There's no way he could stand up to them. So So, if they were willing to pay him for his services, hell, what was the harm? The leader of the group, Jack Brandt, was a large man with long black hair, a black beard, and a scar that cut through but did not obliterate his right eye. He insisted upon being called Major. Brandt's second in command was Wiley Stone, and he was called Sarge. Though they had taken over the sheriff's office, both Brandt and Stone seemed to spend most of their time right here in the Gato Rojo Saloon. Sitting at the table with Brandt and Stone were Brad Preston, three-fingered Bill Manning, and a young tough who called himself Waco Jones.
Hey, Count, bring me over a jar of them pickled pig's feet.
Yes, sir, Sarge, right away.
Con brought over a jar and sat it on the table. Stone stuck his hand down into the vinegar and pulled out a pinkish-white pig's foot, and he began gnawing on it.
What the hell are they shooting at?
Don't get so jumpy, man, and they're just having a little fun.
Preston watched Stone as he continued to gnaw on the pig's foot.
How you can eat them pig's feet is beyond me.
Stone merely smiled at him, took another bite, and smacked his lips in exaggerated appreciation.
It damn near makes me sick just to look at you.
That's because you never tried them. Hell, I think they're good. Fact is, I think I'll have me one myself.
Waco stuck his hand in the jar.
How the hell would you know what's good? You still wet behind the ears. What are you now, 17? 18?
I'm 18.
Tell me, Waco, how old was you when you had your first woman? Or have you even had yourself a woman yet?
I'm not sure how old I was when I had my first woman, but I know that I killed my first man when I was 15. I killed the son of a bitch for ragging me.
Here, that's enough of that. We have plenty of enemies without. We don't need enemies within.
I wasn't fighting, and I didn't mean nothing by it. I was just having a little fun, that's all.
I don't like that kind of fun.
Hey, Major, you reckon King has figured out yet that it's us that hit him?
I doubt it. I don't think King is all that smart.
Must be a little smart. I mean, to have a ranch that big, you'd have to be a little smart for that, wouldn't you think?
Having it is one thing. Keeping it is another. By the time we get through with that son of a bitch, he won't have two coppers to rub together.
Hi, Major. What you got against this here fella King anyway?
Do you know who King is?
Yeah, sure I know who he is. He's Captain Richard King, and he owns a big ranch, but that don't tell me what you got against him.
This man, Captain King, is the self-same son of a bitch you got the Major and me put in prison. And we was doing no more than our duty. I mean, the son of a bitch was feeding the Confederate army. That made him a legal target for our raid, far as I'm concerned. Only the government didn't see it that way. And the reason they didn't see it that way was because King is such a rich bastard, he bought them all.
Well, hell, Major, if you got something against him, why don't we just kill him? You want me to kill him? I'll kill him for you.
Oh, don't you worry about that. We're gonna kill him, all right. But not until we break him. I want him to die a poor man.
What's our next move?
We need to raise a little cash. I figure the next time we go back to Captain King's ranch, we'll cut out about 200 head. One of the reasons I chose this town as our headquarters is that it is very close to the Mexican border, and I found a man who will pay us $10 a head for all the cattle we can bring to him.
$10 a head? Hell, Major, they're paying three times that up in Kansas.
And when they start to herd to Kansas, we'll go along with them. But in the meantime, we need some operating money. Unless you have a couple of $1,000 you want to throw into the pot.
I ain't got no money. Leastwise, nothing like that. All I got is about $10.
Then we will take the money where we can get it. Unless maybe you think you can run this outfit better than I can.
You're the boss, Major. I didn't mean nothing by what I said. I was just talking, that's all.
Like more than half of the men who were riding with Brandt, Preston had been in prison with him. Though Preston had only served 5 years, while Brandt and Stone had each served over 15.
Preston, I want you to go into Corpus Christi tomorrow and meet someone that's coming in on the train.
All right. What's his name?
Pew. Dingus Pew. He was in prison with us. You remember him, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
I told him he could join up with us, but I need someone to meet him and tell him where we are.
Sure, I'll do it. I'd be glad to. I'm always ready to go into Corpus Christi.
Yeah, I thought you would be.
Alice King enjoyed her trip to Austin. When she was younger, she had attended finishing school in Austin, and while there, met Loretta Dixon, the daughter of a state senator. The two young women became fast friends, and they've been exchanging letters and occasional visits ever since. Although Alice loved the ranch, she did sometimes miss some of the things she had enjoyed while attending school in Austin. Austin had theaters and operas and fine restaurants, to say nothing of the excitement of it being the state capital where one could attend sessions of the Senate or the Assembly and watch state government in action. But even more than the cultural aspects of the city, she always enjoyed the opportunity of visiting with a girlfriend her own age. Although she lived in luxury on the ranch, she was somewhat isolated, so she very much enjoyed the opportunity of being around another young woman of her own age and approximate social station. What she particularly liked was being able to discuss very personal things with Loretta. And during this trip, she had told her all about Bob Kleberg. They laughed as they made plans for her wedding. It was late evening as Loretta stood with Alice on the train depot platform.
You will be sure to invite me to the wedding, won't you?
Of course I will. Why, I intend for you to be my maid of honor.
Pink. All the bridesmaids must wear pink. I look good in pink.
Then pink it is.
What is it?
Oh, poor Bob. Here we have the wedding all planned out, even to the color of the bridesmaids' dresses. And he doesn't even know yet that we're getting married.
Well, what he doesn't know won't hurt him.
Oh, the train is coming. Oh, I guess it really is time to say goodbye.
Did you take a room?
No, it's just an overnight trip. I'll be there shortly after breakfast in the morning. A berth in the Pullman car is all I need.
Because it was dark when the train pulled out of the station, Alice had the porter make up her berth right away. She was in bed within half an hour, and partly because she was tired from so much activity during the week, and partly because of the relaxing rhythm of the train, Alice was asleep quickly. She slept soundly all through the night. Had Alice ridden in a parlor car, she would have met the Jensens. For in addition to chartering a cattle car for his stock, Smoke Jensen had taken two rooms in the Wagner parlor car, one for him and Sally, and one for Cal and Pearlie. The center of the car was, as the name indicated, a parlor, richly paneled and carpeted, and with overstuffed seats that could swivel to allow passengers to look out at the passing scenery or face inside for conversation. At one end of the parlor area, a large silver-plated coffee urn sat on a serving table. A tray of pastries sat beside the coffee urn. Pearlie walked up to the table and took two of the pastries.
Damn, Pearlie! You had enough breakfast this morning to choke a horse? And now that's about the fifth time you've been back to get yourself some of them sweets. You planning on eating all of them?
Anyone else want one?
When nobody answered, he looked back at Cal.
No sense in letting them go to waste.
I would say that you're going to spoil your dinner. That'd be a laugh. Nothing kills your appetite.
Sally was reading Harper's Weekly magazine, and from time to time she came upon something interesting, she would share it with Smoke.
Smoke, have you ever seen a telephone?
No, I can't say as I have, but I've heard of them.
What about Mr. Edison's talking machine?
Well, yes, I did see one of them in Denver.
Well, listen to this smart idea. It is not clear as to what purpose Mr. Edison's talking machine will be put, but what if some clever scientist could find a way to connect it to the telephone? Then, if someone engaged the instrument to contact the house of a subscriber who was absent, Mr. Edison's talking machine could answer the telephone and record a message that the subscriber would retrieve at a later time. We do live in such a marvelous age.
I'd like to have me one of them telephones.
What would you do with it?
Why, if I wanted to go for a walk or a ride with a pretty girl, I just call her on the telephone. Hello, I'd say. This here's Calvin Woods. Would you like to go riding with me this afternoon? You would? Well, fine. I'll be by for you at 2:00.
See how easy that'd be?
Yeah. And it'd just be that much easier for her to tell you no.
It had been a four-day run down from Big Rock, and though the car had been comfortable, Smoke was glad the trip was nearly over. He got up to stretch and then reached for his hat.
Where are you going?
I thought I'd just go back and check on the livestock one last time. I'll be right back.
Want me to go with you, boss?
Nah, no need.
5 years ago, Private Dingus Pugh went absent without leave from Fort Clark, Texas, riding an army horse and carrying an army pistol. He was arrested when he tried to sell the horse in San Antonio. He was court-martialed, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. While in prison, he met Jack Brandt and Wiley Stone. When Brandt got out of prison, which was 3 months before Pugh's sentence was to end, he recruited Pugh for his army. The idea that he could get rich by working with Brandt appealed to him, so Pugh agreed and was given instructions by Brandt on where to find him. Now, he was sitting in the dining car, nursing a second cup of coffee as he ogled a beautiful girl at her breakfast. That was one thing about prison. There were no women. And having only been out for 2 days, he really hadn't had the opportunity to meet one. But his luck had just changed, and he intended to meet this one. When she finished her breakfast and left, Dingus left as well, hurrying after her. He caught up with her on the second vestibule.
Hey, hold it, miss. You dropped something.
All the while Alice was at her breakfast, she had been aware of the man staring at her. It had been unpleasant, but because they were both in a public place, she had not let it worry her. But being confronted here on the vestibule between cars was a little disconcerting. She started into the next car, but before she could reach the door, he leaped across the vestibule plates and stood in her way. In fact, he was now standing in such a way so as to force her to the side of the vestibule, blocking her from going forward or returning to the car she had just left. She could smell the smoke from the engine and feel the wind against her.
What do you want?
I told you you dropped something.
No, I don't think I did.
You dropped this here money.
No, I didn't. If you found it, someone else must have dropped it.
But I seen you drop it. You ain't calling old Dingus a liar now, are you, Missy? That it wouldn't be very nice now, would it?
Then, if I dropped it, you may have it. But please, just go on and let me return to my seat.
I tell you what, Missy. I seen that there was a stock car back there that's bound to be of some soft hay. What say me and you go back there? You showed Dingus a good time, and this here $10 is yours.
What? Sir, how dare you make such a proposition to me?
Dingus pulled his pistol out of his holster, pointed it at her, covered it with his hat.
Here's the thing, little lady. You're gonna go back to that stock car with me whether you take the $10 or not. Because if you don't, I'm gonna shoot you right here and throw you off the train.
You... Oh, you wouldn't dare! You would never get away with it!
Oh, yes I would! As much noise as these here train tracks make, nobody would even hear the gunshot. Now what do you say? Are you gonna come back with me?
At that moment, Smoke Jensen stepped out onto the vestibule. Seeing a man and woman there, he smiled at them.
Good morning.
Oh, morning! Say good morning to the man, Martha.
Good morning.
Nodding, Smoke stepped on by him and into the next car.
Well now, you handle that just fine, Martha. Now, let's,
That was as far as Pugh got, because Smoke came back out of the car, grabbed Dingus by the scruff of the neck and the seat of his pants, ran him toward the edge of the vestibule, and shoved him off. Smoke turned back toward the woman, who had watched the entire scene in pure shock.
How? How did you know?
I saw that he was holding a gun under his hat. I didn't make a mistake, did I? You didn't welcome his company, did you?
No, sir, I assure you, you did not make a mistake. I did not welcome his company, and I thank you.
Glad I could be of service.
Captain Richard King, his wife Henrietta, and Robert Kleeberg were sitting in the restaurant of the Hotel Peabody in Corpus Christi, the remains of a late breakfast on the table before them. From the large window in front of the restaurant, they had a magnificent view of the bay. Several ships were tied up at the docks, almost equally divided between sailing ships and steam vessels. Some of the ships belonged to King, and when they had come into town the day before, he had met with a few of his captains, as well as with the man who ran his operation out of an office in Corpus Christi. He had also exchanged telegrams with cattle buyers in Dodge City.
The going rate right now is $32 per head, and they expect that price to hold through the next 3 months.
10,000 head, with an anticipated attrition rate of 12%, should return $281,600.
Not a bad payday for someone who started his work career at $6 a month, is it?
No, sir. It's not bad at all.
Did you check on the train?
Yes, it's on time.
Well, Mrs. King, what do you think? You think your daughter enjoyed her visit?
King pulled his watch and looked at it.
Well, if the train is on time, like you say, she'll be here very soon. Should we go down to the depot?
Richard,
What is it?
Before we go, there's something I need to tell you.
Oh? Well, what's that?
I'm sorry if I cause you concern. It's just that someone else is coming on the train.
Someone else? Who?
Please forgive me for my secrecy, but I would rather wait until he is here.
All right. I suppose I can wait to find out.
The depot platform was a bustle of activity when the train pulled into the station. There were those who were waiting to leave on the train, those who were meeting the arriving passengers, and many more who had no purpose than to just watch the train come and go.
Well, there she is. Alice, we're over here.
Alice embraced her mother first, then her father, and finally, with an embarrassed smile, Cleaver.
Oh! They're beginning to unload the baggage car. I bought some lovely things while I was in Austin. I am going to keep an eye on them to see that they don't destroy anything.
Henrietta smiled and walked away with her daughter. Standing among the crowd awaiting the train was Brad Preston. Dispatched by Brant to meet Dingus Pugh, he watched the passengers as they stepped down from the train. Three Finger Manning and Waco Jones had come to Corpus Christi with him, but neither one had come down to the depot.
You're the only one who can recognize him. You're the one that was with him in prison. Me and Three Finger will be waiting for you in one of the saloons. When your friend gets here, come get us and we'll have a drink or two before we get started back.
Preston would have argued back, but he knew that what Waco was saying was right. When he didn't see Dingus get off the train, he walked over to speak to the conductor.
Is everyone off that's supposed to be off?
Well, why do you ask?
I was looking to meet someone and it didn't get off.
Well, you might try towards the front of the train. Some of the passengers in the parlor car were coming here and they may still be gathering their things for their training.
This here fella ain't likely to be riding in no parlor car. Maybe he missed the train. When's the next one down from Austin?
I believe there will be another one tonight at midnight.
All right, I reckon I can wait on it. I'll just go and have me a few drinks beforehand.
As Preston walked away from the depot, he didn't glance toward the four people who had just gotten down from the parlor car. If he had, he might have recognized Smoke Jensen as the man with whom he'd had a run-in back in Colorado about 10 years earlier. Like Preston, Kleberg had watched the passengers detrain without seeing who he was looking for.
What about this mysterious person you're looking for? Have you seen him yet?
No, sir, not yet.
At that moment, Kleberg looked toward the front of the train and saw Smoke Jensen leading a horse down a ramp from the attached stock car. He smiled.
There he is.
There who is?
Towards the front of the train, you see the fella leading the horse down the ramp?
By now, there were three men leading horses down the ramp.
Which one?
The one in front.
Yeah, yes. I see him. What about him?
That's Smoke Jensen.
Smoke Jensen? Wait a minute. Do you mean the Smoke Jensen? The famous gunfighter?
Yes.
Well, it'd be interesting to meet him, I suppose. I mean, I've certainly heard a lot about him over the years. But I'm curious, how did you happen to know he'd be on this train?
Because I sent for him.
You sent for him?
Yes.
I don't understand. Why would he come just because you sent for him?
Because he owes me a big, big favor.
And that brings me to my second question. Why did you send for him?
Well, I figured he could help us out with our problem.
Look, Bob, I know you did what you think is right, but I don't want to do that.
You don't want to do what?
I don't want to use a hired gun to take care of my problem.
Richard, he's not exactly a hired gun. As far as I know, he's never actually hired his guns out to anyone. Besides that, He is a wealthy man in his own right. I doubt that he would even take money for his services if you offered it to him.
Then what would make him get involved?
I told you he owes me a favor, and he has a very strong sense of what is right and what is wrong.
He sounds like an admirable man.
He is, Richard. He is one of the finest men I have ever met.
Well, that makes me all the sorrier that you didn't check with me first. I hate putting an honorable man through all this, but I can't use him, Bob. I just feel that it would only make matters worse.
All right. I'll go talk to him and tell him that it was all a mistake and that we won't be needing him after all.
I'm sorry, Bob. I just wish you'd checked with me first, that's all.
No, sir, I'm the one who should be sorry. I clearly overstepped my bounds on this, and I put myself in an awkward position. I have no one but myself to blame.
As Kleberg started toward the train, he saw a fourth horse being led down the ramp by a very pretty woman. And he realized that she, like the two young men, was with Smoke. That was going to make it even more difficult for him to tell Smoke that he wouldn't need him after all. Smoke looked up as Kleberg approached, and then he smiled and stuck out his hand.
It's been a long time, but unless I'm wrong, you are Mr. Kleberg.
I am, but please call me Bob.
Sally, I want you to meet Bob Kleberg. I owe him a lot. Because if it hadn't been for him, why, I would never have gotten to meet you. Bob, this is my wife, Sally.
I am very pleased to meet you, ma'am.
And are you? Smoke has told me many times how you arranged for the pardon for him and Preacher.
Yes, well, I'm glad I could do it. They were good men, being unjustly pursued.
And this is Pearly and Cal. No accounts, the both of them. But they're my friends nevertheless. And since I don't know exactly what you have in mind for me to do, I figure having these two along would be to my advantage. What is it?
Yes, well, the truth is, turns out I brought you down here for nothing.
No? You mean the problem has resolved itself?
Not exactly. Mr. King doesn't want to use any hired guns.
I can understand that. But we're not exactly hired guns. I'm not here for money. I came down to repay a favor for a friend. And any friend of a friend is my friend.
Oh, it's not the money. It's the idea of bringing in outside guns. I'm sorry. I'm really very sorry.
Upon seeing the difficulty Kleberg was having in telling, Smoke broke into a wide, easy smile.
Don't worry about it. We'll spend a few days in town and look around and enjoy the sights. Then, go back home. We've been needing a vacation anyway.
After they got rooms in a hotel and had lunch, Sally decided she would like to spend the afternoon shopping. Cal offered to go with her to carry any packages. Smoke said he would check out some of the local saloons, and Pearly decided to go with him. Smoke and Pearly were standing at the bar, the Boar's Head Saloon, at about mid-afternoon when the batwing doors slapped open and a young man stepped in. He was scratched and bruised, and his clothes were dirty and torn. When he saw Smoke standing at the bar, he went pale.
You! You threw me off the train, you son of a bitch!
Yes, well, it seemed to be the thing to do. You were threatening that young lady, and throwing you off the train seemed to be the best way to take care of it.
I'll bet you never expected to see Dingus Pew again, did you?
That would be your name, Dingus Pew?
Oh, that's the name, mister. I figured you might want to know the name of the man that's gonna kill you. I see that you're wearing a gun. Well, you get ready to use it.
Well, are you gonna open the ball?
Pew stood there for a moment longer, neither speaking nor moving.
Go away, Pew. I don't want to kill anyone today.
Pew glared at Smoke, and then he put both hands up and shook his head.
No, sir! I ain't gonna give you no excuse to kill me, no, sir!
Turning, he pushed back out through the swinging doors. Pearly and Smoke stayed at the bar for a while longer, not yet ready to leave. Smoke just happened to glance in the mirror behind the bar when he saw Dingus Pew charge back into the room, bent over, his shoulders thrust forward, his face set in a scowl. He was raising the shotgun to his shoulder even as he came in.
You're gonna die, you bastard!
Just before Pew pulled the trigger, Smoke pushed Pearly to one side while he dove to the floor on the other side. Before Pugh could fire the second barrel, Smoke Jensen returned fire. Within 2 hours after the shooting, an inquest was held before the magistrate's court, with Judge Spicer Wells presiding. Smoke hadn't been arrested, but he was asked to attend the inquest, and he did so without protest. Nobody knew Dingus Pugh, and nobody would have even known the name had he not spoken it aloud when he came into the saloon. And though nearly everyone had heard of Smoke Jensen, only Bob Kleberg had ever met him. And Kleberg, who was not a witness to the shooting, had not been called. In fact, the inquest was already underway before Kleberg heard anything about it. One by one, the witnesses testified as to how Dingus Pugh had come into the saloon challenging Smoke Jensen. They told how Jensen faced him down without drawing against him and how Pugh left. Then they told how Pugh came running back into the room a second time, this time carrying a shotgun, and Smoke was forced to defend himself.
Mr. Jensen, would you take the stand, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sally was sitting next to Smoke in the court, and Pearlie and Cal were sitting next to Sally. Sally squeezed Smoke's hand as he stood up, then walked to the front of the courtroom. A Bible was thrust before him.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please take the witness chair. Now, your name is Smoke Jensen?
That's right.
There is a man of some note said to be very, very good with a gun by the name of Smoke Jensen. In fact, I know that some dime novels have been written about Smoke Jensen. Are you that, Smoke Jensen?
I am, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Jensen, I don't know as I have ever met a genuine celebrity before. May I say that it is an honor and a privilege to meet you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
At that moment, Richard King and Bob Kleberg came into the courtroom. Henrietta and Alice were with them, and the four took their seats in the very last row. When Alice saw the man on the witness chair, she was shocked.
Now, Mr. Jensen, you have the reputation of being a brave and determined man, expert in the use of firearms, as quick as thought and as certain as death. I did not know Mr. Pugh, nor have we been able to find anyone who did know him. And since I have heard of you, but I have never heard of Dingus Pugh, is it not reasonable to assume that he was not as skilled with firearms as you are?
I suppose so, Your Honor, but I never take anyone for granted. However, I do try to avoid killing someone if I possibly can, and I try to avoid this one as well.
Yes, the witnesses do seem to support you in this. However, that does raise the question as to why he came after you in the first place. I believe witnesses have testified that he said you threw him off the train. Is that correct? Did you throw him off the train?
I did, Your Honor.
Well, that in itself would seem motivation enough to drive a man to an intemperate action. Were you deliberately trying to provoke him?
No, Your Honor, he wasn't. He was protecting me.
Although Judge Wells had cautioned against speaking in court unless addressed, he recognized Alice King. He also knew that her father was not only the largest rancher in this part of Texas, he was also a very wealthy man who had heavily invested in several businesses in Corpus Christi. Taking all that into consideration, he didn't chastise Alice for interrupting his court. Instead, he just followed up on her comment.
Miss King, would you like to expand upon the statement you just made?
Do you want me to come up there and sit in the chair?
No, that won't be necessary. You can stay where you are. The court reposes enough confidence in your veracity that you need not be sworn. But please tell us what you mean when you say Mr. Jensen was protecting you.
Alice told about seeing the man in the dining car while she was having her breakfast. She then told about trying to return to her car, only to be interrupted on the vestibule between cars.
He took out his gun, covered it with his hat, and pointed it at me. That was when Mr. Jensen happened to pass by. At first, I thought he didn't realize I was in danger because he just went on. Then, a moment later, he reappeared from the car, grabbed the man who was accosting me, and threw him from the train.
Mr. Jensen, I will accept the young lady's testimony as to your motivation. However, I cannot but wonder if there would not have been a better way for you to deal with him upon the occurrence of your first meeting than the injudicious act of throwing him from the train. On the other hand, when we consider the condition of affairs incidental to a frontier country, The lawlessness and disregard for human life, the existence of a law-defying element in our midst, the fear and feeling of insecurity that has existed, the supposed prevalence of bad, desperate, and reckless men who have been a terror to the country and kept away capital and enterprise, and considering the testimony of those who witnessed the event of this morning, I can attach no criminality to your act. I am therefore going to find that the decedent, Dingus Pugh, died by an act of justifiable homicide. This court is adjourned.
With the adjournment of the court, nearly everyone rushed the smoke to shake his hand in congratulations. Though for many it was merely an excuse to meet the legendary Smoke Jensen. Alice, her parents, and Bob Kleberg hung back for a long time, waiting until nearly everyone else was gone before they approached Smoke.
I didn't get a chance to thank you before.
You thanked me enough a few minutes ago when you convinced the judge that I didn't toss the fellow off the train just for the fun of it.
Smoke, this is Captain Richard King, my employer, and the owner
of the Santa Gertrudis Ranch. I'm a rancher as well. I don't believe there's a rancher in the country that hasn't heard of Captain King, the ranch and the Santa Gertrudis breed of cattle. It's an honor to meet you.
The honor's all mine. And you have my gratitude, sir, for coming to the aid of my daughter in her time of danger.
Anyone would have done it. No, let me introduce you to my wife and friends.
Smoke introduced Sally, Pearlie, and Cal. Then he met Henrietta.
Captain King is the reason I asked you to come down.
Oh?
Yes, and I want to apologize, Mr. Jensen, for doubting you. That is, doubting the type of person you are. You see, I didn't want to resort to using a gunfighter to fight my battle for me. I thought... Well, never mind what I thought. I was wrong. And if you're still willing to offer your assistance, I'd be more than willing to accept it. In fact, I'll go beyond that. I'm asking for your assistance.
I came down to do whatever I could do to help my old friend, Bob Kleberg. And since that means helping you, I'll be glad to do anything I can do for you.
Wonderful. Where are you staying now?
We've taken rooms in the Dunn Hotel.
We're there as well. We were going to start back today, but...
Oh, there's a dance there tonight.
And she wants to go for some reason. Though, for the life of me, I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, if you're still willing to help me, despite my bad-mannered rejection of your earlier offer, I'd like for all of you to come back to the ranch with us tomorrow.
There's no need for you to put yourself out on our account. We can stay here or take accommodation somewhere close to the ranch.
Nonsense. There's nothing closer to the ranch than Corpus Christi. Certainly nothing that would be a decent place for you to stay. You'll be my guest at the ranch, and I won't take no for an answer. Besides, you'll be much more comfortable, and I know you'll eat better.
Eat?
You just said the magic word for my friend.
Your friend likes to eat, does he?
He will eat anything that doesn't eat him first.
And if it plans to eat him first, it better get a head start.